Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We now have a full hour to talk about the issues that Dr. Martin Luther King brought up in Milwaukee 50 years ago in November and the issues that are good to think about on all days of the year. But this has been a particularly difficult time, I think, with voting rights restriction, education, how we should educate our young people, the gap between minority and income, and also in terms of how everybody is doing on testing, the jobs that are available or lack thereof, the very high incarceration rate for minorities in the state of Wisconsin. There are many, many issues that need serious attention, and we're going to talk about many of them this hour as we continue our conversation. Sheila Cochran is with us, Secretary Treasurer, Chief Operating Officer of the Milwaukee Area Labor Council. Eric Vaughn is also here, no stranger to radio, a longtime talk radio host on WMCS in Milwaukee. He is president of Vaughn Communications, a public relations firm, a two-year radio project, Precious Lives, about children and gun violence is one of his latest endeavors. It premiered last week on public radio in Milwaukee. And he's editor and publisher of Brain, Brawn, and Body, Advancing African American Men's Health. Our phone number, we'll welcome this conversation to you, is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the email, if you want to use that, is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter. I want to start, just because of the popularity of Selma and the fact that we're thinking about voting rights, and we were during the last election, to examine what's happened with voting rights, certainly an issue that people died for and that film pays special attention to. The League of American Voters has looked at 20 states that they have identified this year that will have high to moderate rates of passing reforms that will suppress the vote next year, a big election year. 19 states where they remain hopeful that pro-election reforms could become law. Can both of you address this issue that was so much a part of the civil rights struggle and that is so movingly portrayed in that film, and where it stands now, and if you would put it high at the list of issues to be concerned about? Do you see a national suppress the vote movement taking place and an equally strong movement to make sure that voting is open? Sheila?
I do. As a matter of fact, our labor council is one of the plaintiffs on the lawsuit for the state of Wisconsin that's now been taken. We've appealed at the United States Supreme Court. I was frankly shocked that it got stopped before the last election. But as far as I'm concerned, any impediment to people being able to cast a vote, I don't care if it's voter ID, I don't care what it is, again, a step backward. And for all of the reasons I think that Dr. King was fighting for. Now, I haven't seen the movie Selma, but I have been an advocate, and I'm very aware of what the League of Women Voters is doing in the state, and so I'm extraordinarily glad that they're there, because they are literally vigilant daily at the Government Accountability Board and elsewhere in this state to make sure that there are some eyes on how voting rights are, along with a lot of other organizations. So I think that, you know, we had a lot of people not understanding voter ID. And one of the things that happened in the state of Wisconsin was the restriction around your birth certificate and how you now get voter ID, the free ID card. All of which had to do with you having to have a live birth certificate and having to have that document to prove that you were born. And we had people, and I can't remember, unfortunately, the woman's name, who died prior to the lawsuit going through, who would not have been able to vote once that law was passed. And there's a gentleman who I think is still alive in the city of Milwaukee who had nothing like that, because the only thing he has is his Social Security card, and his plight was brought up in this lawsuit. And people are very quick to say, well, you know, I think it was always compared to, at the time, you need a ID to get a, you know, movie or something from Blockbuster. But you're doing business with Blockbuster. Voting is your right. you have options about where you purchase things and the other things that you do. But voting is a right, and our rights shouldn't be restricted by additional things. We have poll workers that we discovered in the state of Wisconsin, in the city of Milwaukee, who did not know what a passport was, never seen one. So even if you went with a passport, they didn't recognize it. And I can tell you from experience, the stuff that you have to come up with for a passport is extensive. And so if there is anything between you and your ability to cast a vote that restricts you in any way, shape, or form, your right is being taken away. And I think that people don't exercise that right enough. They don't vote enough. I have never missed a vote. So I'm never going to talk about things that I don't have a lot of knowledge about. And it is the one place where there is some equity. And I say some equity because we also know that there are those forces around us that would try and take that away in other means. And so you always have these suspicions around whether or not machinery is working and this is working, or for that matter, whether or not enough dollars have been allocated for people to be able to cast their vote during a regular election. So, can't foresee what will happen at the United States Supreme Court. Never even thought it would get that high, quite frankly. But I can just say thank goodness for Justice Kagan stepping in and stopping it before it got even more confused in the last election. And since it is in the appeal process right now, unless it's, I guess, stepped up very quickly, it may not be even effect even in the spring races. But I would suppose, given some of the other things that have happened, that if people aren't appropriately identified with an ID card of some sort or other, be it the state ID or a driver's license or some of the other documents that they now allow, that they should get themselves identified. And they should care about voting.
Eric, how do you explain, here was an issue that, we thought was settled. And it was horrendous in this country for such a long period of time. And now here we are in 2015, and after 2010 elections, this movement started again to restrict voting. And it's happening along very partisan lines in this country. There are some states democratically led that are opening voting. There are Republican-led states that are doing the opposite. How do you explain this? How can this be happening after such a long struggle to secure the right to vote?
Well, I think if you take the simplest answer, it's there are some people who are tired of losing, so they want to ensure victory at every level of government. And I think that gets to the heart of why people like you and I, when we are on the radio, and Sheila as a guest all of those years on Election Day, encourage people to get out to vote. Sometimes you do look, I know I have, look back after Election Day and said, you know, why did I go through this? Why am I telling people to vote? Why am I spending so much time on this? Because nothing seems to change, at least toward the positive end. But then you understand it when you see the incremental changes that occur in both directions, good and bad. This idea, if you take the intent to restrict people's right to vote in parts. You may think it's insignificant. You may think it's unimportant. I know for a long time I was one of the people, and I admit that I was one of the people who said, if you can get an ID card for this, then why can't you get one to vote? Or, I never thought, at least at first, that the ID card battle was one that we should be so up in arms over, that just go get an ID card. And then as I watched more things come into play, more attempts to restrict the vote, the ID card issue is one thing. I would imagine that some of the same people, except for the absurdity of it, who advocate for there to be an ID card requirement, voter ID requirement, they would also advocate for there to be literacy tests again. We go back
exactly
that far.
I've heard
so
it.
With each of the efforts to limit your right to vote, my right to vote, or whoever they're going after, again, taken in parts, those things may not seem that important. But when you add all of those things up and you look at one community after another, that's adopting those kinds of restrictions, or at least even trying to. It tells you very clearly what the attitude is of people who have been on the losing end, as they see it. You know, we're giving up too much ground to them. So we need to do something about it. So I don't think that anything is off the table as far as they're concerned. We'll try anything we can to control the whole electoral process. And it's a game. It's a very tough game. Politics is just an ugly game. And sometimes we, when I say we, I mean people on the side of the, you know, side of the fence that we're on, where we're fighting against those who want to restrict our right to vote. We don't want to fight as hard. We don't want to get down and dirty. We think that there's something noble in taking the higher ground. They're willing to go wherever they have to go to win. And we have to adopt that same attitude about it, or else we're going to lose.
We're welcoming phone calls during our wide-ranging conversation this day that we honor the life of Dr. Martin Luther King. Our phone number, feel free to join us as we look at issues that remain crucial in 2015. So many of them were a part of what Dr. Martin Luther King fought for and have yet to be realized. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Joanne in Milwaukee, our first caller. Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Hi, Sheila, and hi, Eric.
Hello, Kathleen. I mean, Joanne.
I called because I have seen Selma. And Eric mentioned about kids learning the words to Martin Luther King's various speeches. One of the things the director of Selma couldn't do, as I understand, was use the actual word of Dr. King's speech. So all of the speeches are controlled by somebody else, and she couldn't use his actual words.
I had heard
that. She had to write her own speeches. And I think she did a wonderful job of catching the feeling and the emotion and the logic of what he said using other words. So I think from that point of view, Selma is very educational.
I had heard that the King children had sold the rights to all of those speeches to Steven Spielberg. Have you heard that?
Yes.
That's true.
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't know it was Spielberg. Yeah. She just said another producer owns all the rights.
Well,
so she had to write the speeches herself.
Uh-huh.
And I think she did a good job of putting into other words what he was saying.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that was no easy task.
There's a great book that I used to use, and I have referred it to many, many people over the years. It's called Testament of Hope, the Essential Writings and Speeches of Dr. Martin Luther King. It's a great book. It has many of almost, if I'm not mistaken, it has all of the popular speeches that everyone is familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
But it also has a number of other speeches that, you know, he delivered in small venues or in places before people actually were following him. And then it has a number of his writings that never became speeches, but they were different things he wrote when he was in prison or in jail. I should say not prison, but in jail. There were just a lot of good stuff in this book, but it's a softback book that I had originally in a hardback. I lost the hardback, and I had to buy it in softback. So I try to keep it close. But it's a great book. It's a great teaching tool. It's pretty big.
Yeah, and one of my favorites I brought with me, and it's called.
Oh, you did.
Yeah, it's called All Labor Has Dignity, and this one's by Michael K. Honey, and it has speeches in it too. And I was looking for something in particular, and I ran across this line, and it says, I might cite the arresting fact that the only state in the South which repealed the right to work law is Louisiana. This was achieved because the Negro vote in that state grew large enough to become a balance of power, and it went along with labor to wipe out anti-labor legislation. And I think that that is the crux of all of this. And that speech, frankly, was given to the AFL-CIO in 1961, where Dr. King was attempting to convince the House of Labor of the importance of the black vote and black workers, because this book is dedicated primarily to work having dignity. And that is why we have the problem we have right now with voting rights, because it is a balance of power. And Eric is exactly right. When you are immersed in politics like we are and like I am in particular, you see an awful lot of polls and ways people vote. And I don't care what poll you look at. I don't care how you break down the vote. If there are black people in any particular section of town or in this city and across the nation, you can look at the black female labor vote as the most progressive vote you're going to get and the highest number. Right behind would be black men in labor. And then the demographic breaks to black people in general, how they vote, and then Latino people and how they vote, white women and how they vote. And the least likely group that's going to fall in line with progressive voting, if that's the way you want to define it, is going to be white men. And this has been the way it has been across the spectrum for a very long time. Doing that, when it becomes, and I've always used this phrase, it's a numbers game. It's like point shaving. When you can shave off a couple of points in the city of Milwaukee and a couple of points here and there, when you can suppress the vote, I don't care how you do it. You can do it physically, as we've seen sometimes around here. You can do it through the airwaves, or you can spread misinformation. However you choose to do it, that is how elections are literally won now, because you've got two solid camps of folks that are going to vote one way or the other. And then you've got that middle that everyone fights for. And the funny part about all of that and the pathetic part about all of that is that if that demographic that is so aggrieved would go vote, those elections would be landslides. They just don't realize it because no one articulates it in that way. And it's hard for people to see because they don't, as Eric will say, they don't see a reason for their vote having to be counted.
Yeah. Joanne, just a quick aside to you. We did a show last week with a historian who wrote a book on the Voting Rights Act who was concerned about the historical accuracy of Selma, particularly LBJ's portrayal. Was that of concern to you or not?
No, it wasn't very much of a concern. I thought his portrayal was a little bit off because, as I understand it and what I've read about Lyndon Baines Johnson, he was more concerned than he was portrayed in the movie. But I think we have to remember that it is still a movie. It's not a documentary. And for the point of the drama between LBJ and MLK, I think it was acceptable. Mm-hmm. But when people see Selma, they have to remember that it is a movie. And if they really want to know the relationship between the president at that time and the civil rights movement, they should do a little more reading and do a little more research to find out what actually happened. But this is a place to start. And look at all the conversation that Selma has.
I know. How true.
I think that's good.
Yeah.
I wonder why it's not just Selma, but if you think back about any somewhat historic presentation of black life, there's always this question about the authenticity of it. I think, you know, as I think Joanne is pointing out, it's a movie. And there's always license afforded to the creators of these theatrical, moments that allow them to add a few points here, miss a few points. But I think if the general thrust of the movie hits home, I heard, I don't know if it was the same person that you're talking about that you had on your show, but someone was on one of the CBS shows a week ago, and they were bringing up the same point that this portrayal of LBJ in the movie makes it less than believable. I would imagine the movie's 2 hours long. There had to be more moments in the movie that were spot on than incorrect. And I haven't seen it. But, just from what I've read and people coming away from it, the reaction they had to the movie, they appreciate the movie. And I don't think anybody feels like, it's not like Django Unchained when people walked out of there. They were totally misled about what history was as it related to black cowboys. But that's not the case with this movie.
I see your point. I have a problem. If we're going to learn our history, though, it is true that LBJ went to bat for the Voting Rights Act. It just is. And to have him portrayed as somebody who was quite the opposite if you worked for LBJ, I mean, he has his own burden to bear with the disaster in Vietnam. You may as well give him a little bit of credit for something that he did do, which was move the Voting Rights Act through.
But I would imagine that there was some tension. I mean, I don't.
Sure.
I mean, just given where he was from and the times, it couldn't have been something he woke up one morning and said, hey, I'm all for this. I mean, that just wasn't the attitude of America at that time, at least not for white people. So to think that he may have had a bit of consternation over it shouldn't seem surprising.
It's interesting because my daughter saw it. And she sent me a message afterwards, and I asked her, how did she like it? And she said, it was well done. And she said, but she had to cover her eyes to some of the violence.
Oh, I know. It was horrific.
And I said, a lot of that we saw rolled out on television.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, one of my issues with going to see the movie, I realized, and I told this to some folks, I've got a book on my iPad called The Assassinations. And I said, I lived through an extraordinarily violent period of time in this country. And I said, and we have to put what Dr. King was talking about in context to that violence, the war, the riots, all of this kind of stuff, and everything that was going on down south.
Right.
And I recall very vividly as a child, because my mother was from Columbus, Georgia, and there were two ways back in those days that we would drive down. All of them included Highway 41. And we were driving down the year that King was marching. And I remember this conversation that my parents were having about that drive and who was going to drive first, who was going to drive second, and if they were going to go through Montgomery or if they were going to go the other way through Atlanta. And the decision was made to go through, and we got stopped. And at the time, I didn't realize how much danger we were in because we got pulled over by a chain gang. Literally, black men imprisoned with black and white stripes on, chains on their ankles, guarded by a white man with a guard with a shotgun. And the man walked up to our car, pulled us over, and walked up to our car and asked my mother, who is a very fair-skinned woman, and my father for matches, wanted to know if they smoked. And we got instinctively very quiet. And my father leaned over because the guy came up to the passenger side of the car where my mother was and said, I'm taking my wife down to visit her parents in Columbus, Georgia. And he articulated exactly why we were in the South. And we were in a white Buick with Wisconsin plates. And I can imagine now how that may have appeared. And they looked in the back seat at us very carefully. And then we were allowed to go forward. And I think about that instance now in a whole different context than I did as a child. Now, once the car got going again and once we got down south and we were with our grandparents, that memory just kind of left me until we got back home and we started to watch more and more of what was playing out in Montgomery and Selma and other places. And so I think that, again, like we were talking before we got off the air, when you look at these generations and these big divides of time and the things that have gone on, whether they're whether you're going to look at LBJ as the very astute politician that he was at the time, having taken over a country after an extraordinarily popular president was assassinated. And I remember this state and how the big question was, whether you're going to have a Catholic president and how he's going to have the Pope run the country. I think you look at it in the context of the time that you were in. Now, I don't know why I started to look at the world so politically as early as I did in life, but I will tell you that the only time, I can tell you I've only seen my mother literally cry out loud twice in her life, was my father passed last year and when Kennedy died, when Kennedy was shot. And that day when I got home and, we were in school and I got home and I saw her, I knew that time was literally standing still because this was a woman who's not only very strong, but who's very extraordinarily articulate in her politics. And she has always been that way. And I know why now. I didn't know why exactly then. And so I think that we have to be very conscious of those things. The best we can do, and it's unfortunate that our history, and I believe that black history ought to be taught like everyone's history is taught in school. I think it ought to run in tangent with the other historical facts that we lay out, and we ought to talk about it more, is because I can say as a black person, we are equally as guilty as not wanting certain things to be talked about, as not wanting certain things to be taught, because they are so extraordinarily ugly. You know, we'd like to have things done in a certain way. And so I think there's really, if you were to ask it, there's no real agreement on how you would teach black history. And the reason there's no agreement is because there's so much that hasn't been talked about. You know, you look at this time right now, and you've got a generation of very recently born young people who have no regard for the president that we have. They have no idea how extraordinary it is for him to even get there, and not even how prophetic Dr. King was in saying how soon one might be realized.
Right.
So I think that, you know, we have a lot that we forget, and I've been reminded of it. You know, a lot of things ought to be written down. You ought to pass them along. But we all need to know that history.
Yeah, and John Lewis making the comment that if it weren't for what happened in Selma, in some way, that had to happen for Barack Obama to become president, too, which is true. There's truth
and the things that happened to him.
Absolutely. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Thanks, Joanne, very much for your call. Our phone number is, our lines are filled, 800-486-8655. We're talking about race in Wisconsin on this day. We honor the life and the birthday of Dr. Martin Luther King. Eric Vaughn and Sheila Cochran are with us in our Milwaukee studios. We'll be back with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls. Let's go to Larry in Milwaukee. Hi, Larry.
Hello, Kathleen. I'm glad you've got someone as knowledgeable as Eric and Sheila on today. I don't know if you talked earlier about Eric's radio project, but it's extremely disappointing that Wisconsin Public Radio and, by the way, Milwaukee Public Radio don't seem to recognize the importance of having a daily or at least a weekly call-in show hosted by a local African-American and focused on issues that are particularly relevant to people of color in Milwaukee and the area. I think you lose thousands of potential listeners and donors by not doing that.
I couldn't agree with you more.
I second that, Larry. Thank
me
you
too.
So much. And whether it's me or whoever, I even said to Kathleen when we started today, I'm offended, actually, by WWM's efforts to engage in conversation about black people in this community. And they invite in people to participate in those conversations when they could have a daily forum or a weekly forum. And I'm one who doesn't believe that every conversation hosted by a black person has to be about black issues. But I think that it's something disingenuous in the effort when you could very easily put a black voice on your station and do what you're trying, what you say you want to do. And you wouldn't have to make an extraordinary effort to do that.
Right. And it was a real loss for this community. We should talk a little bit about the press for WMCS to go down. I used to listen to you all the time, as you know. It was an important voice. You know, we still are an incredibly segregated community, and we should have diversity of voices in all media. I think we're better on television in this community than we are on radio, certainly. But it was also an important voice because we are segregated for an African-American community that tends to live in the city of Milwaukee.
I think I would agree with you that we certainly do have more black faces on television than we have in radio in this community, I think particularly around news and information.
Right.
But the problem with television in this community, and your first caller, Joanne, would probably second this, is that you just don't have the freedom on network television in this town to do the kinds of things that we're able to do on radio. You know, as a talk show host, you can entertain almost any issue you'd like to entertain, and you can approach it from your perspective. That's not possible for someone on one of the television stations in town who's doing news. And You know, it's a foregone conclusion, I guess, that, well, black folks shouldn't host television shows in this town. They shouldn't be part of the intelligent conversation about issues that we confront in this community, because there are no black people doing that in this town. So somebody's made a decision. I think I was probably the last person, and my wife might have been the first person, who said that the effort to change WMCS, to kill off what we had established at WMCS, was something deeper than just the economic issues that I was familiar with, that I thought were behind the change that occurred there. But when you look at what happened here in Milwaukee, not only with WMCS, but, you know, the stifling of the press, the stifling of broadcast outlets, and you compare that, or you add that to what's happening in other cities around the country, you look at even the national scene, where on CNN, they've gotten rid of several of their black anchors and hosts of shows. There is a silencing that's occurring. Now, you know, someone could easily say, no, that's not orchestrated, but it looks like it. So it doesn't matter whether it is or isn't. It accomplishes the same thing, and that is, again, that silencing of black opinion.
So if you put Dr. Martin Luther King, not that we want to do this all the time on this day, but you can't help yourself, into Milwaukee in 2015, he would have a hard time getting a job as a talk show host?
Well, he'd have a hard time even getting heard. You know, I've always said, I used to say to people all the time, if you bring Barack Obama, President Obama, to town, where's he going to go? He can't sit down with Charlie Sykes. He can't sit down with Mark Belling. He probably could, but he probably wouldn't appreciate it very much. So you really need an outlet, and it doesn't have to be, in that case, it doesn't have to be a black person that hosts the show, but it has to be, as Sheila was talking about earlier, a place that has a progressive thought in mind. And that's just not the case, other than here now. And, you know, where do you go?
Yeah. So. Thanks, Larry, for your call. Willem in Colfax. Hi, Willem.
Hi. I'm always reminded around this time about, you know, Martin Luther King's speech, I Have a Dream, is always a speech that's given in the rotunda. And I think that's great, but I think that I grew up in those times, and I remembered that he was down there fighting for the garbage workers union, and he was standing up for unions and economic justice. He was against the military. He was against, I mean, the militarization, the war in Vietnam, all these things that he spoke out against. And I also was reminded today when I listened and I heard the governor was there. Our governor is if Martin Luther King led a demonstration there, would he threaten to call out the National Guard? And also he called the people who demonstrated for union rights, he called them union thugs when it was a peaceful demonstration in Madison. And they're trying to, work against making a right to work state, limiting our ability to vote, the times of voting, all these sort of things are under attack. So I think Martin Luther King would be in Wisconsin today, and I think he would be speaking out on the same issues that face us today. And you know, like, we have to always be vigilant for our democracy when it's under attack.
Sheila.
I would agree. And I don't think that, I think the caller was right on all points. And that's why when I was talking about this book, All Labor Has Dignity, it literally is one that sits behind me on my desk all the time because, you know, in my line of work, I can make all kinds of assumptions about how things are. I can look at facts, and Lord knows I look at them an awful lot, but people don't want to really listen to them as often. And, you know, going to what Eric said, at the same time that, and I remember that very well, because the same month that Eric's show went off, and I was a frequent guest, thankfully, we lost our labor press, same time. And so labor's voice in this community really got silenced because there was no way. I mean, I can assure you, because I've been blackballed, I can't call WTMJ.
Really?
No. Years ago, and it was funny the way it happened, my daughter called in, and she called in on a topic that they were talking about, and that's the only way she got through. And then once she got through, and I think this was the Belling show, she voiced an opinion on what she really called about versus what he was talking about. And I had a meeting, a fairly high-level meeting, several weeks later with someone who's left this town. And he said to me, Mark Belling is really mad at you. And I said, for what? And he said, you called in this program and portrayed yourself to be talking on a topic. I said, first of all, I've never called a show. I said, because I'm not stupid. I would never get through. And I said, further, he literally was talking about me, either I think him or Charlie Sykes one year, because I had the temerity to write a letter to then Representative Scott Walker, because he was dabbling in local politics around a personnel issue at MATC when I was the chair. And I used the word edification. And I said, for your edification, personnel issues are always talked about in closed session. And he must have given them the letter. And they had a field day with the fact that the chair of the MATC board was trumping her education by using the word. And so I was not only not a fan, I was thinking about the idiocy of these people who would take a statement of fact and minimize it. And now this man is the governor of the state of Wisconsin. So trust me, there's no way that labor's voice would ever be heard on either of those stations. And wouldn't want to, at least not in this day and time, not with that foolishness.
Let's talk about, thanks, Willem, for your call, labor issues for a moment. One of the issues, and Martin Luther King talked a great deal about the other America, poverty in America, and boy, does that issue still stay with us to such a large extent, particularly in this community. He mentioned in that Milwaukee speech a public works program to put people back to work. What is it that labor, what would reinvigorate labor in 2015?
I think the availability of work opening up. A lot of it is, I mean, you have to, these days it's Lord knows I wish it was one huge public works project, but we also know we have people that would not and don't want to always do that type of hard, heavy physical labor. It's interesting. I just had this conversation with someone within the last week, and we were talking about the way the workforce looks in Wisconsin. And I said, let's talk about the way it looks in Milwaukee. I said, you know, we often have this conversation. I'm sure, you know, I'll just bring it up because I'm sure at some point someone's going to try. And that is the lack of black workers in the construction industry. I said, you know, they hammer on the construction industry an awful lot because you can see those jobs. You can see those folks outside. I said, I don't hear anybody hammering on what's inside of these buildings. So when I, you know, we can look out your doors here, out your windows here. I bet you I don't even know what this building is, but I can guarantee you it's not 50% black labor in it. And it's not going to be 50% black labor in any private sector industry. You're going to find that black labor in public industry, because in the public city, and the county, under law, as well as lawsuits, in most cases lawsuits, black workers have gotten in, and they've been kept in there by lawsuits. That's primarily the way most black workers get to work. Somebody sued you because you didn't have enough black workers, or you didn't have enough women, or whatever the lawsuit was, and so now you're duty-bound to keep your profits in order to have black workers. One of the things that this governor did with Act 10 was eliminate that, because now, without there being a union in place or a collective bargaining agreement in place, you can't negotiate those numbers anymore. You can't make sure that you have the appropriate amount of the workforce in the way it looks or should look. So there are a lot of jobs, I think, that would be available if the industry were there. But then you have to go back to how people are educated and what they want to do and how they want to do it. So we see an awful lot of people that leave here. And then you get a brain drain, and it's not always a white brain drain. It most certainly is black youth. I can count my daughter as one of them. She left here. And she left here as a union organizer and chose to do her work from Chicago because she had more opportunities there. as she still does. Here, the doors are closed, and it's not just within the trades. I can say honestly that the trades do a better job now of trying to get people in their doors through Big Step and other, you know, and other ways than the private sector does. But that is a conversation that we won't have. Hmm. You know, sometimes we're very happy that, you know, we have a high-placed executive somewhere, or, you know, it looks good, but it's not as good as it should be.
More phone calls, more discussion with Sheila Cochran and Eric Vaughn in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tomorrow during this time period, we'll be speaking with a Nigerian-based journalist who's written about the militant group Boko Haram for The New Yorker and The New York Times Magazine. Last week, I'm sure you're up on this news, there were raids on small towns that killed possibly up to 2,000 people. The attacks seem to be undercovered in the media because of what's been going on in Paris particularly, so we'll get a better understanding of Boko Haram tomorrow during this time period. All right, let's go back to phone calls for Eric and Sheila and Joe in Ellsworth. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I'd like to say shame on Steven Spielberg for holding the rights to King's Words and not releasing them to the public, and I'm dismayed that the family would sell them. King's life is among the most noble things this country has to claim. And, I mean, doesn't Spielberg have enough money? Can he open that up and let the public use those words as they see fit?
Well, there are a lot of people who have enough money, don't you think? Yeah, there are just a lot of people who have a lot of money.
You know, given the almost historic squabbles that have gone on amongst the King siblings,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
it may be in better hands with someone other than them. I'm not necessarily saying Steven Spielberg, but wherever they are,
no.
Who knows what their resolve would be if someone were to try to get them.
Yeah. So. Joan in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi.
Hi, Joan.
I'm coming out in public on the radio that I'm quitting the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that I've read for as long as I've been in Milwaukee, 60 years or so, because they dropped Eugene Kane, and he might appear sometimes on Sunday, we're told, and they dropped an African-American journalist, Leonard Pitts, from someplace in Florida, who was a very wise person. And I just hope for the best for the very good local young columnists and journalists who have developed. But God bless them. We better pray for them. I'm not going to subscribe to the Journal Sentinel anymore.
Thank you, Joan, for your call. And one of the messages coming through loud and clear on this show is what's happened to the media, which, you know, how do you get a discussion of all of these incredibly important issues if you're trying to tout a certain political candidate or if you're removing certain voices from the discussion? I think alarming.
The first thing I should have done when I sat down here today was thank you for asking me to be a guest, because I think that that's what has to happen now, is that all of these places have to open up to people other than who we hear and see all the time now. Again, the TV stations don't do it. You know, they have their alliances, I guess, and that's where they go. But, you know, as long as there are people like you, there's a chance.
Likewise, yeah.
But we all die, don't we? That's what happens eventually. Karina in Toma. Hi, Karina.
Hi. I just wanted to say a couple of things. I was born in Romania, and I lived in Italy. And I have to say that it truly bothers me that in 2015, we still have to talk about races and colors and labeling. I grew up colorblind. I see people. I see brothers, sisters, friends. And it saddens me to see that in the United States, which is the leader among all the countries, there are still people who are discriminated against, that we have to see that they don't have the equal opportunities. And I have a short example. On Sunday, I did a long run on my treadmill, and I watched the movie The Butler. Now, I have to say that I don't have much knowledge about American black history, but I do know some of it. And that movie really broke my heart, and I felt ashamed for what was in the past here. And so I posted on my Facebook that how heartbreaking that movie was, and that I dedicated my long run to all the people who suffered the goal of discrimination and for race and color and beliefs. And nobody from our church even gave me one light.
Thanks, Karina, for your call.
Karina must be in great shape. It's a long movie.
I guess you need a little humor when you talk about all of this, don't you, Eric? Why are all these issues still with us so much? Why is Milwaukee so segregated? Why are the schools segregated? Why is race such a big thing still?
I was thinking, you know, Dr. King was here, what year, 65?
Mm-hmm.
I think about the people who invited him, who obviously saw a great need to have someone like Dr. King come to this city and speak to those issues then. It is disheartening. It's not surprising because we've been living it, but it's disheartening to know that we still have those same problems. I mean, to enumerate those things that he discussed when he was here, he talked about segregation. Just a broad topic: segregation, minimum wage, public work programs, fair employment for police officers, or fair employment policies for law enforcement, and the discontent and desperation. All of those things are present as we speak.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, he mentions the police officers. We were driving home on Saturday night and passed some police officers, two or three squad cars that had pulled over a car. And all of the officers who were approaching the car were white. And this is on North Avenue. And I'm not saying that, you know, it had to be black officers who should have been, but it raises the question. If you're black, mm-hmm. you know, and this happens to me when I'm watching television, you know, and I'm looking for black faces on the TV ads or for the TV programs that are on. But I'm certainly looking for them when I see police interaction on the streets of Milwaukee. Given the number of black people who live in this town and other people of color, we have to have a police force that's representative of the population, and we don't. So, you know, he raised the question in 1965, Dr. King did, about fair employment practices and policies. We should be talking about that right now.
There is certainly an issue that came front and center during the last year, and that's police minority community relations mm-hmm. and the shootings. And that will continue this year. That was a major issue, Sheila.
Yeah, and it's typical across the country.
Right.
It is not, I mean, we are, that's not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
I looked up demographic data of police departments across the United States, and typically all police departments are majority white and majority white male. And Milwaukee, I can't remember where it fell, but, you know, we had lawsuits in order to get black firemen and black police officers. And believe it or not, in the apprenticeable trades in the state of Wisconsin, the people who are the most egregious in not following through on apprenticeable trades are in the public sector. And that fact I have brought up on more than one occasion. If you look within that data and that database that I was looking at, there had been apprenticeships that had not been offered by any of the apprenticeable trades other than the building and construction trades unions, which is why I will always work with them to try and keep doing that. I've brought this up on more than one occasion I know I've brought it up to the mayor, because the water department in the city of Milwaukee has apprenticeable trades, but you will not find new apprentices in those trades mm-hmm. anywhere within the public domain. And that's a shame.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye to both of you. The time just I know, it's almost over. But
you might have to have us back.
I will, if you'll come back. Definitely, you will.
Nobody else will listen to us.
We want
or let
to
us
listen
talk.
To you. Thanks to Sheila Cochran, Secretary Treasurer, Chief Operating Officer of the Milwaukee Area Labor Council, Eric Vaughn, longtime radio host on WMCS in Milwaukee. He is president of Vaughn Communications, public relations strategic planning organization, and he does media work as well. Thanks to KP Whaley and Scotty Myers for producing this program, and to Scotty for on-air production. We're with you tomorrow to talk about anti-Muslim demonstrations in Germany and Boko Haram. So join us for those conversations. Thanks for listening.